Dr. Sheldrake is one of the world's most innovative biologists and has revolutionized scientific thinking with his vision of a living, developing universe with its own inherent memory. He first worked in developmental biology and is best known for this theory of morphic fields and morphic resonance. His latest book, The Sense of Being Stared At, develops his concept of the extended mind. I'd like you to put your hands together and welcome Mr. Rupert Sheldrake.
Thank you. Well, thank you. You've been plunged right in at the deep end this morning with an experiment. You've got in your hands, I hope, some sheets of paper that are probably all Greek to you. I'm going to ask you to take part in a very simple experiment. Before your minds are contaminated with theories or expectations, we're going to plunge straight in. This only takes a couple of minutes, and then we'll get to the nature of the universe. But we're going to start with something more mundane, namely a scientific experiment. You are going to need a pencil or pen for this, so if you haven't got one, I haven't got one either. And so I'm afraid you're going to have to borrow one from your neighbour if your neighbour's got one, and if not, you'll have to borrow it from the next but one person. Take turns. What's going to happen here is, first of all, please fill in the front of the form with three simple questions. Sex, age, and can you read Greek or not? Now, when you've filled that in, could you close the little booklet so that you're not looking at the Greek words? Okay, anyone not ready? Okay, what's going to happen now is that I'm going to show you eight Greek words on this screen, and you'll be looking at them for 10 seconds. After that, if I can manage the technology, they'll disappear. And then you're going to open the little booklet, and I'll tell you what to do. Okay, so look at the screen, and the words should appear now. Okay, look at the words. You're going to try and remember them. Doesn't matter the order, just try and remember them. Okay. Now, open the little booklet and circle eight words on that first sheet. Try to circle the eight words you've just seen. If you can't remember them, you'll have to guess. But circle eight words altogether. Okay. Anyone not finished? All right. Now, what's going to happen is you're going to see the same eight words again in a different order, and you're going to have another chance to remember them. And then you're going to turn over to the back sheet and circle another eight. So you don't need to turn over yet. Just concentrate on the eight words that will appear on the screen in a few seconds. 4, 3, 2, 1, now. Okay. So now please circle eight words on the last sheet on the back of the little booklet. Good. So hopefully you've finished now. Could you pass them all to the end of the row, please, and we'll collect them up. That's the experiment's over. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'll explain what you've just done a little bit later. But that was an experiment in morphic resonance, and I'll explain exactly what it was later. This is, as you see, a very simple test. It has huge implications, but I'll wait until I've explained a bit more about the theory so I can explain the test. What I'm going to do this morning is talk about memory in nature, the idea that the laws of nature are more like habits. And I'm going to talk about morphic resonance and the collective memory, which is inherent in all species. This is, at first sight, a very radical hypothesis. But what I'm going to argue is that this is something that we're all going to have to think about whether we like it or not. Because science is in a state of crisis. Two of the most fundamental paradigms or models of reality in science have come into head-on collision with each other. Most people don't realize it's happening because it's happening slowly. It's more like two great tectonic plates colliding, and when they collide, you don't notice anything. Then there's an earthquake or a volcano or something. These two tectonic plates of theory are crashing into each other, and they're going to force us to change our worldview. Now, I think that the change they're going to bring upon us is a change towards the idea of a memory in nature, the whole of nature, the whole universe, having a memory. In order to put it in context, I'm going to talk about these two worldviews. And this involves a sort of fast forward through 2,500 years of intellectual history in about 5 minutes. So you're going to have to fasten your seat belts for this. What I'm going to do is show how these two fundamental models that we've all inherited, that we've all got part of in our psyche, are in collision and are going to force theoretical changes. The two fundamental models I'm thinking of are ones that we've inherited from the Greeks and the Jews, the two main ingredients of Western civilization. They are the ideas of eternity, the idea that nothing really changes, and the idea of evolution, the idea that everything changes and develops in time. The idea of eternity is something we inherited from the Greeks. The ancient Greek philosophers were obsessed with the idea that behind this world we live in, there's a timeless realm, a realm where nothing really changes. They probably got this idea from mystical experiences. Lots of mystics through the ages have said they've experienced a realm beyond space and time. The Greeks may have been influenced by mystery cults, mystical groups of people, influences from Asia, we don't know. But the fact is that the Greek philosophers were each trying to find their own solution to the mystery of eternity. They came up with different answers. Pythagoras and his school came up with the idea that the ultimate eternal reality is mathematical, that behind the world of appearances there are eternal mathematical truths, ratios and proportions and harmonies, which are true everywhere, at all times and in all places. Plato generalized the Pythagorean insight and had the idea that behind everything in the world there's an eternal archetype. Every horse, for example, is a reflection of an eternal horse idea, an imperfect reflection of an ideal form or archetype of the horse. And this is the realm of Platonic ideas or forms, usually written in philosophy books with capital I or capital F for ideas and forms, so you realize it's not just the regular use of the idea of the notion. So those were two ideas that said that the eternal reality is beyond space and time, outside space and time, essentially living in some kind of eternal mind. The atomists or materialists came up with a different answer. They said that the only reality is matter, and matter is made of lots of little bits called atoms, and these endure forever. And the changing world we live in is because of the changing combinations and movements of the atoms moving in a void. So for them, matter was the eternal reality. And then Heraclitus, who was a kind of maverick among Greek philosophers, said that the only thing that remained constant was change itself. Well, he had less influence, but the Platonists and Pythagoreans had an enormous influence on Western philosophy. As Christianity took off in the Eastern Mediterranean, it had to be brought into relationship to the prevailing Greek philosophy. Christianity developed in a Greek world. The New Testament is written in Greek. And with the language of the New Testament comes the whole implicit philosophy of the Greeks. And it was relatively easy for early Christian theologians like St. Augustine to see how the Platonic philosophy could be fitted into a Christian theology. The Platonic forms or ideas were none other than ideas in the mind of God, aspects of the Logos, the second person of the Trinity. And God thought these ideas eternally. So that was a fairly easy assimilation. Platonism was somewhat eclipsed in Europe in the Middle Ages by the rival school of Aristotle. But at the Renaissance in Europe, there was a big revival of Platonism. And European intellectuals got very excited again about this eternal reality behind space and time. The founding fathers of modern science were all Platonists or Pythagoreans, believing that the ultimate reality is essentially eternal, mathematical, beyond space and time. They thought that the so-called laws of nature were eternal mathematical ideas in the mind of God, and that scientists could actually reveal or read the mind of God through discovering these mathematical laws. So when Newton came up with his law of gravitation, this wasn't seen as just a temporary human model. It was seen as the unveiling of the mind of God, the eternal mathematical truths in the mind of this mathematical God. The idea that God's a mathematician is perennially popular among mathematicians. And of course, of all people, it makes them closest to the divine. So this was a very influential idea, and at the Enlightenment, the end of the 18th century, when there was this cult of science and reason, the idea that human beings could understand ultimate truth was a very big part of that. In the 17th century, there was also a revival of atomism, the philosophy of Democritus. And the idea was that matter is made of lots of little bits, atoms. And basically, 17th century science, which laid the foundations for the sciences we now have, was a kind of cosmic dualism of material atoms governed by eternal laws, which were beyond space and time, that were themselves not physical. But they governed the physical atoms. No one explained quite how, but that was what was laid into the foundations of science, and has remained so till this day. In the 19th century, the permanence of the atoms was enshrined in the principles of the conservation of matter and of energy. And the conservation principles say the total amount of matter and energy and angular momentum and electric charge are always the same. And the laws that govern them are always the same. And that's why science is supposed to be, any experiment supposed to be repeatable anywhere at any time, because the laws of nature are the same at all times and in all places. This is the implicit philosophy underlying science. The universe is eternal, matter is eternal, the laws are eternal. And most physical and chemical scientists just take this for granted. When you look at the Mendeleev's periodic table of the elements in chemistry, you don't have any sense that this could have evolved. It's like a Platonic form of the elements and how they are, a kind of rational order of things. In the 17th century, the founding fathers of modern science, who were all Christians, believed that the universe, although essentially eternal, was actually created by God in time. God was like a great machine maker who created the laws of nature and the universe, pressed the start button, and then the whole universe went on like a great machine. That was what they thought. But by the end of the 18th century, with the growth of atheism, people wanted to get rid of this engineering God who started off the universe. There was a simple intellectual move by which you could do this. Just proclaim that the universe is eternal. Then you don't need a God to start it off. And that's what Laplace, the great French physicist, did. When Napoleon asked him what place God had in his scheme of things, he said, "Sir, I have no need of that hypothesis." Because they'd already got a stripped-down version of God as a kind of mathematical engineering creator who just started things off and then stood back. And by making the universe eternal, you could get rid of that kind of creator God. So the universe was eternal, the laws were eternal, the matter was eternal, the energy was eternal. When Einstein worked out the equations of his general theory of relativity, he found that they showed that the universe should either be expanding or contracting. He couldn't believe that was true because the universe must be eternal. So he introduced the cosmological constant into his equations to make sure it stayed the same. He later considered that his biggest mistake. But the universe, because it was later discovered, the universe is actually expanding. But that was a huge shock to Einstein, because so deeply embedded in the thinking of physicists was this idea that everything's eternal, that it was a terrible shock for him to find that perhaps the universe isn't eternal, that it's unstable, it's expanding. Well, these are the ideas that have got totally built into our conception of reality through physics and chemistry, this notion of eternity from the Greeks. But the other great notion that's changed our thinking is the idea of evolution, and that is rooted in the thinking of the Jews. The Jews were the only ancient people who saw time in a linear progressive way. All the other great civilizations and people of the ancient world saw time as eternal, moving in cycles. They saw eternal cycles. Whole universes came into being and passed away, and new ones appeared forever. So the eternity goes with the idea of cycles, and that goes with the idea of reincarnation. The ancient Greeks believed in those things. The Indians do to this day. The Buddhists, with their cosmology derived from the Indian one, implicitly do as well. So the idea of eternity is the standard default setting for most ancient civilizations. The Jews were different, though. They had a model of history that was modeled on a journey, and the prototypic journey was the journey out of bondage in Egypt, through the wilderness, and to the promised land. This was a journey with a goal. And the goal originally was like the recreation of paradise, of like rediscovering Eden, the promised land where there'd be peace, prosperity, brotherhood. It would be like rediscovering Eden at the end of history, paradise. So this is the kind of archetypal journey. It has a goal. Of course, when the actual Jews arrived in Palestine, the promised land, then as now, it turned out to be inhabited already by Palestinians. So instead of being a place of peace, prosperity, and brotherhood, it was a place of strife, conquest, bloodshed, internecine squabbles and feuds, and much of the Old Testament is taken up with these endless battles with the indigenous people of Palestine. So this ideal ending of history had to be projected into the future, when the Messiah would come. And Christianity took over that cosmology, and then there was the idea of the second coming of the Messiah, the end of ordinary history. The idea that history was moving towards a goal or culmination, preceded by a catastrophe, and then followed by some new order of time. Interestingly, in the 17th century, this essentially religious vision of history was secularized. The leading figure in this movement was Sir Francis Bacon, the Lord Chancellor of England. And Bacon had the idea that, yes, history would be transcended, we'd come to a whole new order of history, and that would come about through science and technology. Through conquest of nature, man would achieve a completely new relationship to the world, and human prosperity would be increased all over the world. He used very sexist language. He said, through putting nature on the rack, like witches were put on the rack, we can torture her and force her to yield up her secrets so that man can achieve dominion over her. Well, this has been the ideology underlying science and technology ever since. And his vision was that governments would sponsor a kind of scientific priesthood. Each country would have a kind of National Academy of Sciences as the officially approved scientific priesthood that would, under government control and direction, enable human beings to dominate and control nature, unleashing a new era of prosperity. Well, that vision of progress through science and technology has now conquered the world. No other ideology has ever conquered the world as that one has. Every government in the world is now into economic development through science and technology. It's an enormously successful vision. It's also at the root of our environmental crisis. It's produced all the damaging effects that we're living with today, and fearing more of in the future. But this is an idea that had a huge influence. By the end of the 18th century, most European intellectuals and American intellectuals had adopted this philosophy. It was part of the Enlightenment cult of science and reason. And this led to the idea of human progress. But the rest of the world was thought to be static. The universe was eternal, species of animals and plants were fixed, only humans underwent this progress. It was essentially a religious idea in a secularized form. But by the middle of the 19th century, the idea of evolution was extended to all of life. In Charles Darwin's Theory of Evolution, 1859, the idea was that the whole of life evolves. All living beings have appeared, they've developed through time, through a vast evolutionary process. Darwin hardly ever used the word evolution, I think only twice in The Origin of Species, his most famous book. Instead, he used the word progress. And so he thought this was the progressive view of life being extended to all of nature. So now we had human beings progressing through science, technology, and social reform. We had now the whole of life progressing from humble beginnings through more complex life forms right up to the present day. But the rest of the universe was not progressing. Some philosophers, like Herbert Spencer in England, and Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, said that progress must be a universal law, not just a biological law. But the physicists said, no, forget it, that's not what's happening. The universe is eternal, and not only is it not progressing, it's actually running down. By then they discovered the second law of thermodynamics that says that no, you can't have perpetual motion machines. So they had the idea that the whole universe was eternal but gradually running out of steam, so that it would eventually freeze up in a universal heat death but then remain frozen forever. So instead of the universe progressing, it wasn't. It was going downhill. And by the beginning of the 20th century, European intellectuals, more in Europe than America, were obsessed with the ultimate futility of life on Earth, human life, because all of this, all of evolution here was a flash in the pan in a universe doomed to extinction, a universe headed nowhere. A pessimistic, kind of cosmic pessimism. By the 1920s and 30s, people were beginning to realize the universe was expanding. And in the 1960s, with the discovery of the cosmic microwave background radiation, the Big Bang Theory became orthodox in physics. So since 1965, we've had the idea that the universe began very, very small and very hot, less than the size of a head of a pin to start with, and it's been expanding and cooling ever since. And as it expands and cools, new forms of matter come into being, atoms, molecules, stars, galaxies, planets. Everything in the universe has evolved. Nothing was there in the beginning of the Big Bang except this seething mass of undifferentiated heat and energy. So now we've got an entire universe that's evolutionary. And evolutionary cosmology has extended what was originally a Jewish religious vision through these progressive developments, through Christianity, through the early profits of science and technology, through economic growth and development, through biological evolution, to the entire cosmos. Now, this is a huge change. It means that one of these worldviews, the evolutionary worldview, has now become completely predominant on a cosmic level. Where does that leave the eternal laws of nature and the eternity of matter and energy? Well, it leaves them sort of hanging in a void, because and if you ever meet any of these hard-nosed, aggressive materialist types, try out a question on them. Say, do you believe in the Big Bang? And they'll almost certainly say yes. And then you say, well, where were the laws of nature before the Big Bang? And you see, if they're eternal, they should have existed before the Big Bang, but where? There's no where for them to be. There's clearly a metaphysical or philosophical idea that is nothing to do with hard-nosed empirical science. And science is actually based on this implicit philosophy. In fact, modern science is based on an idea that my friend Terence McKenna used to say, that it's based on the idea of give us one free miracle and we'll explain the rest. And And the one free miracle is the coming into being of the entire universe, all the matter and energy in the universe, and all the laws that govern it, from nothing in a single instant. The Big Bang theory is radically evolutionary, and it raises the question that if everything else evolves, why can't the laws of nature evolve too? Why not? I mean, there's nothing, we can't prove they were all there in the form they are today at the moment of the Big Bang. Everything's evolutionary, why not the laws? And as soon as you ask that question, you realize that the concept of laws of nature is very anthropocentric. The idea of law is it confined to human societies, in fact, to civilized societies. It projects onto the whole of nature a very human concept. As C.S. Lewis once said, to say that a stone falls to earth because it's obeying a law makes it a man and even a citizen. And so it's an extraordinary metaphor when you think about it. And if you do think about it, you realize that human laws do actually evolve. The laws of the U.S. are not the same today as they were 100 years ago. So as a metaphor, it would imply evolving laws. But I think it's a very poor metaphor, and I think a much better one is habit. I think as the universe evolves, it develops new habits. Through repetition, habits become more and more repetitive, more and more predictable. And they become more and more as if they're governed by eternal laws. But with new phenomena, then you can actually see habits build up. This essentially is the idea of underlying morphic resonance. Morphic resonance is a theory that tries to explain how the universe can have developing habits. Habits imply memory. And how would this memory work? Well, the suggestion is that it depends on similarity. The more similar something is to something that's happened before, the more it will be influenced by it. And morphic resonance is the process whereby similar things in the past influence similar things today. I'm not proposing that there's a kind of cosmic memory bank where all this is stored. Memory is not a spatial phenomenon, it's a temporal phenomenon. It's to do with relationship in time. And I think morphic resonance depends on a kind of direct resonant effect of anything in the past on anything in the present that's sufficiently similar. By anything, I mean self-organizing systems like molecules, atoms, crystals, plants, animals, societies, planets, solar systems, galaxies. All of these organize themselves. They're radically different from machines, which are organized in accordance with human designs and put together in factories. In nature, most things organize themselves. In fact, everything organizes itself. Self-organizing natural systems have an inherent memory. And what I'm suggesting is that each species and each kind of thing has a kind of collective memory. Every individual contributes to it and draws upon it. We all draw upon a collective human memory, and in turn, we all contribute to it. Every spider draws on a collective spider memory, including spinning webs, and contributes to it. Every migrating swallow depends on memory of the species, including previous migrations over the centuries. So this, in a nutshell, is the idea of morphic resonance. I put it in simple ordinary language because it's easy to get in ordinary language. Of course, it needs to be worked out in a more scientific form, and I'll say something about how it works through morphic fields in a moment. But first, I want to make the point it can be tested by experiment. And one of the easiest ways to see how this could happen is to look at crystals. This theory applies to the chemical realm as well as the biological. And in the realm of crystals, most people assume that crystallography is completely understood everywhere. It's fully understood by physicists how crystals form. Turns out that's not the case. Crystals form and physicists can find out what structure they have, but they can't predict it in advance. Because as soon as you get into any degree of complexity in chemistry, the way the atoms and the molecules could line up to form the crystal It turns out there's hundreds of ways they could do it, and they only do it in one way. Sometimes in different ways, then you get polymorphic crystals. Usually in just one way. So, if you make a new chemical that's never existed before, and chemists do this every year, then what form will its crystals take? The conventional view is that this should, in principle, be predictable on the basis of the eternal laws of nature, the laws of quantum mechanics, electromagnetism, thermodynamics, etc. In practice, no one can actually do these calculations. They're too complex. So it turns out that we don't know that that's true or not. It's just an assumption. But according to morphic resonance, the first time the crystal forms, there won't be any previous crystals of that kind. There won't be an existing form that will force it one way rather than another. You just have to wait until the crystals spontaneously form. Sometimes it takes years for a new compound to crystallize. Once it's happened, according to morphic resonance, it should be easier to do it anywhere in the world because it's happened once in one place. The second time it happens, it'll be easier because of the first time. The third time, it'll be easier still because of the first and second times. They'll have a resonant influence on the third lot. The fourth lot will have influences from the first three lots of crystals. There'll be an accumulative memory, and it should get easier and easier to make crystals of that kind as time goes on, as other people make them in different parts of the world. Is this true? Well, it turns out that it is. It's well known to chemists that new compounds are very hard to crystallize. As time goes on, they get easier. But they don't explain this in terms of morphic resonance. They explain it in terms of anecdotes. And the favored anecdote, believe it or not, among chemists, is that this happens because fragments of previous crystals, which are known to be able to nucleate crystallization, make it happen more easily, that fragments of previous crystals are carried from laboratory to laboratory around the world on the beards of migrant chemists. And if there haven't been any bearded chemists visiting, it's assumed that they've been wafted around as invisible dust particles in the atmosphere. Now, these theories are testable, but they've never been tested. Chemists take it for granted that the phenomenon can be explained by stories of this kind, because they're so convinced that the laws of nature are eternal, they don't see there could be any other explanation, like morphic resonance. I'm saying that it should get easier to crystallize these compounds as time goes on, even if you exclude migrant chemists and filter dust from the atmosphere, it should still be easier. And that's a test. It turns out there's another test. If the crystal, the morphic field of the crystal gets stronger through morphic resonance, it should be harder as time goes on to break up the crystals. In other words, you'd need a higher temperature to make them break up. In other words, their melting point should increase. Now, anyone who's studied chemistry will know that melting points are supposed to be constant. They're a feature of a given chemical. You look them up in books in science libraries called Handbooks of Physical Constants. It says on the cover, constant, so you expect them to be constant. So could melting points actually increase? Well, this is a very, very heretical thought, and I was trained as a chemist to start with, and it certainly took me a long, long time to be able to challenge the belief in the fixity of melting points. I then decided to look at the history of melting points. I'm perhaps the first person to have done that, because it's assumed they're constant. No one looks at their history. I first started by asking chemists if they'd noticed that melting points went up. And I felt a bit shy about asking chemists something so heretical. So the first chemist I asked was Sasha Shulgin, the designer of designer drugs. And I thought, he's a psychedelic-taking designer, drug designer. At least I can ask him this question. So I did. And far from reacting with shock and horror, he said, well, sure, you know, when you make new compounds, you often find the melting point goes up over time. So I said, well, how do you explain that, Sasha? And he said, well, he wasn't thinking of morphic resonance. He just gave a kind of conventional chemical explanation. He said, well, as time goes on, you get better at making it. They're purer samples, and purer samples have higher melting points because impurities lower the melting point. Well, that's true. And actually, since then, I've found every chemist I've discussed this with has come up with the same answer. Well, if melting points go up, it's just because you're getting purer samples. And I said, well, how do you know they're purer? And they said, well, they must be purer because they've got higher melting points. So I decided to look at a range of compounds that have been around in nature for millions of years in crystalline form. You wouldn't expect to see a change after millions of years, billions and billions and billions of crystals. Then you'd hardly notice any difference today. They probably reach some kind of asymptotic limit and stabilize. But new compounds should show increases in melting point, ones that have just been crystallized in recent times. Well, here is an example of melting points of amino acids. And on the left we have amino acids that do crystallize in nature. Asparagine, cysteine, and glutamine all occur in nature. And these graphs show that the melting points have hardly changed. 1935, 1980, 1996. These melting points are indeed constant, as you'd expect if melting points have morphic resonance effect in them, and these have been around in nature for a long time. On the other side, we see amino acids that were first isolated and crystallized in the 20th century. L-leucine, for example, there it is in 1930, and by 1958, its melting point had gone up about 25 degrees centigrade. Here we have L-tryptophan in the middle. Its melting point in 1901 was 252. It's now 289. So we see these big increases in melting points, not fractions of a degree, but tens of degrees. This is one set of comparisons. Another set here are compounds that occur in nature and then chemical derivatives only made in the recent century or so. There at the top is L-cocaine, which occurs in coca leaves, and there's very little change. Cocaine hydrochloride, the cocaine of commerce, made by extracting coca leaves with hydrochloric acid, has shown an increase in melting point of about 14 degrees since 1915. Penicillic acid is in excretions of molds. Penicillamine, made in the chemical industry as a derivative of it, has gone up from 192 to about 213. Here's salicin that occurs in willow bark. It hasn't changed. Here's aspirin, acetyl salicylic acid, first invented in the 19th century, used obviously as a very common kind of drug, that's gone up considerably. So here are some actual data from the archives of chemistry that suggest this is going on. It should be possible to do simple experiments in chemistry to find out if this is in fact applying more widely. But this preliminary data suggests something really is happening. In biology, morphic resonance would predict that if you get organisms to develop in an abnormal way, the more often they do it, the easier it should get. Here's a normal fruit fly, which is a favorite organism of geneticists, an unfavorite organism of many householders. But unfortunately, this became a real personal clash for me when I proposed doing a whole series of fruit fly experiments at home. And I had a terrible problem with my wife, who banned fruit flies in our house. So that's the regular fruit fly. Here's a mutant one where the balancing organs, the halteres, have been turned into an extra pair of wings. So these are unusual fruit flies. Now, it turns out you can find these with mutations, but also if you treat the eggs of fruit flies with ether 3 hours after they're laid, you can produce the same abnormality without genetic change, a bit like thalidomide babies. Chemical change in the environment can lead to an abnormal form. If you do this over generations, the first generation, only about 2% are abnormal. And if you keep doing it, the percentage goes up and up and up till you're getting about 30% abnormal. This has nothing to do with mutations. It shows that by acquiring a characteristic, by an environmental influence, it becomes more likely to happen again. You stop giving them the ether, and the abnormal ones go on being produced in a declining rate over many generations. This is a fascinating finding. It goes against the findings of regular genetics. It's not what you'd expect. But even more surprising is that in this particular experiment, after the 10 generations had been going on, a fresh batch of flies were treated with ether. In the first generation, instead of 2% being abnormal, it was 10%. The second generation, instead of 5%, it was 20%. So it was getting easier and easier for this abnormality to appear. This is what you'd expect with morphic resonance. The same applies to behavior. If rats learn a new trick in Seattle, it should get easier for rats all around the world to learn the same trick. Just by morphic resonance. They don't need to know about the rats in Seattle. They don't need to squeak to them over the telephone. There doesn't need to be any kind of normal communication. There's a kind of collective memory building up. It turns out that people have actually observed this effect. At experiments carried out at Harvard on rats, it was found that rats could be trained to escape from a water maze. The first generation found it very hard to escape. It took hundreds of trials before they discovered. The next generation, it got easier and easier. They made fewer and fewer errors. This suggested that they could inherit something their ancestors had learned. But this is one of the big heresies in biology, Lamarckian inheritance, the inheritance of acquired characters, not supposed to happen. In fact, it does. And in these Harvard experiments, they were very controversial. And people said, well, obviously, it must be genetic selection because in each generation they must have taken the parents that learned smartest, learned quickest as the generation parents of the next generation. So there must have been unconscious genetic selection for smarter rats. So the person who was doing this, William McDougall, professor at Harvard, said, "Okay, we'll do it again, but this time we'll select as the parents of the next generation the most stupid rats." So they should make more and more errors in each generation, according to that theory. In fact, these are the number of errors, and as you see, the number of errors fell dramatically over time with generations of stupid rats. They should have been going the other way. In fact, the stupid rats were finding it easier and easier to learn this, to escape from this maze. It was so controversial, people tried to repeat it, and they did so in Scotland and in Australia. The Scottish and Australian rats took up more or less where the Harvard rats had left off. And they showed the same effect. But the Australians, they got another batch of rats, and in each generation tested rats whose parents had never been exposed to the water maze. They were getting better too. So it couldn't have been a genetic change. So everyone heaved a sigh of relief and said, oh, it's nothing to do with modifying the genes, standard genetic theory is fine. But what they didn't explain was the effect itself. This was left completely unexplained because it didn't fit in. And these data are lying there in the archives and fit perfectly with the idea of morphic resonance. Now, the idea of morphic resonance should also apply to human beings. It should be getting easier to learn things that others have already learned. It should be getting easier to learn to program computers, do windsurfing, skateboarding, any of these new skills that people learn. Most of them are getting easier to do, but of course it could be because of TVs, instructional videos, better designs, new training methods, and so forth. So, to test morphic resonance, you need to do specially designed experiments. One experiment that I conducted in Europe in the 1990s is, in the 1980s even, one of the first experiments involved puzzle pictures. This is a puzzle picture, as used in this experiment. Now, if you look at it, you may not actually see very clearly a particular image that's hidden within it. If you just look at it for a little while, see if you can see it. I'm going to show you the answer in a moment, and I'm going to ask you how many of you actually saw that. I know it's going to be a small minority. Okay, there's the picture. Here's the answer. There's the picture again. Yeah. Now, how many people got that first time round? Thank you. It's about, I should guess, about 5%. Well, what we did, we had two pictures like this. We showed one of them on British television to 8 million people and melted the puzzle picture into the answer and back again, so 8 million people got it. Meanwhile, we tested people in Germany who couldn't see British television. And we, with the two puzzle pictures, the control and the test one, we found that people in Germany found it easier to recognize the test one after millions had seen it in Britain, but not the other one. So this is one of the various experiments that have been done directly to test morphic resonance. Another kind of experiment you've just done, that involves words. Each word has a kind of morphic field. When you read a word, you have a kind of gestalt, a pattern, a form. You don't spell out every word, cat. You just see the word, you get it instantly. That means there's a kind of collective memory for reading words, for real words. But not for false words. If you have the same letters, TCA, for example, it doesn't make a word and you don't instantly get it. It's been found by a number of investigators that if you compare people's ability to remember or recognize real words compared with false words, most people, without knowing they're doing it, can recognize the real words better. You've just done an experiment that involved 8 Greek words, three-letter words. 4 of those three-letter words that you saw were real Greek words that have been read by Greeks for millennia. The other 4 were anagrams of real words that aren't real words. And the question is, will you have remembered the false words less well than the real words? And we've done tests that show that people can't consciously tell the difference between the real and the false words, people who don't know Greek. But so far, I've done this experiment 8 times. 7 times, it's shown a clear, significant, positive result. I don't know the results of this. My assistant's going to have many happy hours of marking your answers. And we'll find out the results probably in a week or two's time. But so far, this kind of experiment is giving very encouraging results, that people have an unconscious ability to read languages they can't read normally, an unconscious ability to recognize real words because of morphic resonance from those who've done them before. One of the very few areas where standard tests have been done over many years where you can look to see if there's a change in time is IQ tests. Similar tests have been done now for decades. According to morphic resonance, the scores on IQ tests should be going up, not because people are getting smarter, but because the tests are getting easier. And so I predicted this in the 1980s, but I couldn't get hold of the data from IQ tests. And I was delighted to find that a scientist called James Flynn did actually do this. And he found that in the US, there's been a very dramatic increase in average IQ test scores since the 1910s, right up to the present day, showing a really significant increase. This has been mirrored in many other countries too. IQ tests are getting easier to do, but people are not getting smarter by any other criterion. This is now called the Flynn effect, and it really baffles psychologists. Flynn himself says he's baffled by it. People have tried to explain it in terms of better nutrition, more brain growth, more TV. They've tried all sorts of things, more exposure to tests. None of these explanations really explain it convincingly, and it remains an unsolved mystery. It's just what you'd expect on the basis of morphic resonance. A couple of years ago, my older son, who was then 16, was doing the national examinations in Britain, which we call GCSE, General Certificate of Secondary Education. Everyone in the country has to do the same exams, and of course they do them at the same time. Before the exams, he came to me one day and very excited, and he said, I and my friends have just thought of a way of getting better scores at GCSE without any extra effort. And I said, well, that sounds a good idea. What's it based on? He said, morphic resonance. And so I said, well, how did you work that out? And he said, well, one of my friends had been reading your book. Note, he hadn't, but one of his friends. And he said, and we were discussing it, we came to the conclusion that if in the physics and maths tests, for example, where there are 15 questions, if we do questions 14 and 15 first, and then go back to question 1, 2, 3, 4, we'll be about 10 minutes behind everyone else in Britain for all those other questions. We'll get a boost by morphic resonance. So I said, well, that's a good idea. And I said, well, there must have been some skeptics in your group of friends. And he said, yes, somebody said, what if morphic resonance doesn't really happen? And so we concluded that if it doesn't really happen, we wouldn't lose anything, but if it does, we'd gain something. So they actually did it. They all did very well, but they're probably smart in the first place. But it turns out this is a very good way of testing it. It also turned out an old friend of mine from Cambridge was in charge of science examinations in Oxford and Cambridge Examination Board. I tried to persuade him to alter the order of the questions for small subsamples of the population to test morphic resonance, to turn our national science exams into a vast morphic resonance experiment. He was intrigued by the idea, but in the end felt he couldn't risk his career on something so controversial. It turns out that in Holland, all exams are done with people at alternate desks have papers in different questions in a different order. A and B forms of the questions. So one lot do questions 1 to 8 and then 9 to 16. For the other lot, 9 to 16 are called 1 to 8 and then 1 to 8 are called 9 to 16. So people at adjacent desks can't copy from each other. That means in Holland they've already got a huge database of exam results that could be used to test this theory. And a colleague of mine at Amsterdam University, Dick Bierman, has already looked at some of their university exam results and found that in 7 out of 8 papers, the morphic resonance prediction has come true. There were higher hit rates, higher success rates when people did questions later than earlier. They're now, at this moment, examining dozens more papers from results from Dutch examination papers to see if this effect shows up. This also applies to crosswords. It should be easier to do the New York Times crossword from today, tomorrow, than it was today. And some tests have been done to test this with positive results. So this is a very testable theory. It leads to the idea of collective memory. And the idea of a collective human memory is, of course, not a new one. Been around for a very long time. Jung, the psychologist, suggested we all tap into a collective memory. And I'm saying the same thing, only I'm saying it's just part of the way the whole of nature is, the way all species are, not just the way that humans are. There's one final implication that's particularly mind-boggling. Well, there's many implications. I only have time to mention one of them. And that is this. If morphic resonance depends on similarity, and we have a kind of collective memory from past members of the human species, then the first point is we'll have a more specific memory from people who are more like us, members of our own families, for example, and our ancestors. So there'll be a more specific memory from our ancestors. But then if you ask, well, who in the past is most similar to me? The answer is me. Each of us is more similar to ourselves in the past than to anybody else. That means that the most specific morphic resonance acting on any one of us is going to be from our own past. This self-resonance means that we can resonate with ourselves in the past, and our memories can be transferred by morphic resonance from our own past. I'm suggesting that memories are not stored in the brain, as commonly assumed, but rather occur through self-resonance with our own pasts. Our brains are more like TV receivers than video recorders. We tune into our pasts when we recover memories, but they're not stored in the meantime in the brain. Because most scientists take the materialist theory of mind for granted, they assume that memory must be in the brain. Where else could it be? It's simply taken for granted. It's one of those paradigms, an unchallenged assumption. It turns out, despite more than 100 years of intensive research and the expenditure of billions of dollars on trying to find memory traces in the brain, people have been extremely unsuccessful. People have tried and tried again, but failed and failed again to find memories in the brain. Every kind of theory has been tried. DNA, RNA, protein modification, synaptic modification, phosphorylation of synaptic proteins, and so on. They've all drawn a blank in one way or another. And I think that's because the memories aren't there. You can no more find memories in the brain than you can find memories in your TV set of what programs you watched yesterday. It's simply not the way it works. Well, this is obviously a radical and, of course, controversial interpretation of memory. But it's a natural extension of the morphic resonance idea. And wherever one extends this idea, it turns up predictions that seem to fit the facts, often in variance to conventional scientific theories. But the memory theory of the morphic resonance memory theory does work, I think, much better than the conventional one. Of course, you can get memory loss through brain damage or through brain degeneration, as in Alzheimer's disease. But that doesn't prove it's stored there. If I came and clipped out random bits of your TV set, I could affect the way it receives pictures or produces sounds, but it wouldn't prove all those sounds and pictures are stored inside the TV set. It would just prove that those bits were important for the reception or tuning, and I think that's true of the brain as well. Well, this gives you a brief overview of the morphic resonance idea. These notions were first put forward in my book, A New Science of Life, much more fully developed in The Presence of the Past. And I've gone on doing research on this in one way or another ever since. And it has many, many implications in many areas. So this is just a very brief view of some of the main features of morphic resonance. I haven't yet talked about morphic fields and how this resonance is expressed. But before I do that, I think it's time for us to take a short break. And then I'm going to come back to the fields, and then there'll be time for questions and discussion after that.